Mr. Keston has a BS from New York University, an MS and PhD in chemical engineering from the University of Pittsburgh. Go Packers. Currently the president of NanoCap Technologies and was employed by Bettis Atomic Power Laboratory, and the bulk of his career was at United Technologies Research. His positions held included Associate Director of Research as well as Director of Research Programs, and in 1997 he was named that company's Distinguished Engineer of the Year. He's also taught at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Art Kessler.
Thank you, Howard. I don't often remember back as far as the times that I was involved with Bettis Atomic Power Laboratories, but if there are enough people here who probably remember the days when Hyman Rickover was sort of running the nuclear navy. And Hyman Rickover was a small man with a very large influence. And I don't know whether you recall, but he had many debates with James Conant about the nature of education. And being a young kid at the time, this is at least 100 years ago, being a young kid at the time, I was always much more impressed with the democratic view of Conant, who actually wanted everyone to be educated well. And Rickover had the idea that the idea was to pick the best students and then invest in them and pick them at as early an age as possible. And I never thought a whole lot of that process, except that I was one of those picked at a relatively young age. So then I thought more of the process. But at any rate, it's an interesting reflection on how our past catch up with us. The subject today is something which is about to become a revolution that we'll barely notice, or two things that will become revolutions that we'll barely notice, one involving the electric grid and one involving the field of air conditioning. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about the first of those, the electric grid stuff, and then see if you guys have any questions, and we'll try to field a bunch of those and then launch into the second one. But first of all, these are both things that flourished during the 20th century, and we all had the sense that something must be going well because we live in a country where everyone has electricity, no problem with the nature of how it was brought to us, and it seemed cheap enough, so we didn't really think a whole lot about it. But the fact of the matter is that something's happening now that's very different. Arizona Public Service sent a note to all their customers about a year and a half ago, and it said, although we use electricity all year long, it is clear that the biggest challenge Phoenix area residents have is saving money on those summertime electric bills. And summer lasts quite a long time here. Not only do we use 50% more electricity to cool our homes in the summer, but electric rates are higher in the summer due to higher demands and higher operating costs of providing that electricity. One of the ways you might be able to save money on your electric bill is to enroll in a rate plan that rewards people for using more electricity during off-peak hours. Well, it seems like a strange letter to get from the utility. After all, they make money when they sell electricity, and the ratepayers were in fact getting a letter that says something about people wanting to conserve, or at least the feeling that conservation of electricity was important. In Austin, Texas, Austin Energy offers free home energy improvements to customers with low to moderate incomes. Improvements reduce energy costs and enhance comfort. If needed, Austin Energy provides materials for and installation of attic insulation, minor duct repair and sealing, caulking around plumbing penetrations, weather stripping around doors, and solar screens. Now, here's a utility that's actually going to do something for you besides charge you for using their electricity. Something a little different was going on. One of the more modern companies of our time, Google, had around the same time, about a year and a half ago, introduced an idea and gave to their own employees what they called a power meter. And people asked Google, what is Google Power Meter? It's an opt-in software tool that allows users to see detailed home energy information right on their computer. It's a secure Google gadget that displays data on home energy consumption received from either a smart meter or another electricity monitoring device. Now, that seemed like an interesting thing to happen at Google, and people said to Google, don't you guys remember that you're in another business? This isn't something that you do. Why are you bothering with all this? Interestingly enough, not only was Google bothering with all this sort of thing, but so were Microsoft, Cisco, Apple, and a few other guys that suddenly were interested in monitoring electricity usage. Well, most of us care enough about electricity to pay our bills, but we frankly don't read them. Most of us, and we just pay them. We don't pay a lot of attention to them. So what's all this action from utilities and from Google and Cisco and Microsoft? And by the way, Ford has an alliance now with Microsoft and Cisco with General Motors to actually have something to do with charging electric cars. What's happening is this. We are all using electricity in a normal way, but about to happen, if you believe the Chevy Volt people and the Nissan Leaf people, and how many people drive a Prius? Anybody here drives it? No. So if you believe that the hybrid car is probably around for a while, and more than that, the plug-in hybrid is about to be introduced. We now have an idea that electricity is going to be a bit more important because we're going to be charging those devices. Well, frankly, we never really think about when we run the dishwasher or when we run different appliances, but if you're going to be charging a car for many hours during the day, you might care about charging it at a time when electricity is cheap. And it might be something of greater interest to you to do that. Google handed their power meter to a couple of their employees, but this is something Google does all the time. They test their devices using their own employees. Google handed their power meter to a couple of their employees. One said, "The dishwasher turned out to be a big energy hog. We now wait to load it fully before starting it, or if it's just a couple of dishes, we wash them by hand. When we turned on our space heater, we're amazed by its power consumption. It definitely gives one a perspective on the true cost of a $20 space heater." Another one of their program managers said, "My apartment is in the basement near the building's shared washer and dryer. After installing Google Power Meter, I saw very large spikes that I could not correlate with any of my activities. Eventually, I realized that my electric meter included the building's washer and dryer. I was paying for all the laundry done in my building. Without Google Power Meter, I never would have figured that out." So, Google got interested early on. Microsoft, Intel, Cisco, GE, and now Apple are beta testing different kinds of variants of a smart meter or a device that is kind of like a circuit breaker where you can actually plug all your appliances in and monitor the use. monitor the use when you're around or when you're not around. Have a laptop and you're on a train somewhere, you can actually monitor the use and stuff like that. And you can change the way these things are used, the way you use electricity. Well, that seemed interesting, but if you have an electric car or a plug-in hybrid that you're going to charge now, you're talking about using a fair amount of electricity. Well, that actually might explain the reason more people are caring about this whole electricity usage business, because now you're going to be using a lot more. What does that mean to a utility? The utility is obliged to supply the energy that you're going to use. I mean, you can have a brownout, but people in California are very familiar with this. Those of you who've actually lived there or visited there know that many communities don't really know how to supply electricity to their consumers, so that you get these brownouts periodically. But the fact is, that's not a good idea. If you're in the business of providing electricity, you want to provide as much as people need. Well, what does that mean in the electricity business? That means you provide enough electricity for peak use, not for average use, but for peak use. So why not for average use? Well, because we don't store electricity. How many of you had breakfast today with the expectation of running a race right after breakfast? Not too many people do that. But people eat and store energy. Biological systems of all kinds, plants and animals, have been doing that for about 3.5 billion years since the beginning of life. Well, the fact is, what happens if you store energy, as all things do, you generally get a chance to use that energy when you need it, not when you get it. So we eat a meal and we generate our energy from the food that we eat and the air that we breathe, and we generate that energy and store it. Well, we don't do that with electricity. Electricity is used as soon as it's generated. Well, that sounds pretty dumb. But we actually justify it by saying, well, we'll kind of distribute the energy. We have this thing called a grid. Well, the grid is not a usual kind of device. Well, let's go back a little bit. In this country, when you make energy, what does that mean? You generally burn a fuel. In this country, 50% of our energy is produced by burning coal. So we burn coal. That's not a thrill a minute. We burn coal. There's some people who think there's a clean coal revolution coming up. Clean coal is an oxymoron, but the fact of the matter is it's this fuel. We burn a fossil fuel. So we burn, generally, more often than not, we burn coal. And then what do? You burn coal, you heat water to make steam, to turn the turbine, that turns a generator that generates electricity. Where does that happen? Well, we've seen to it that happens very far from a population center. Why does it happen very far? Because we're burning coal. We're burning this junk that we don't actually want people to breathe. And if anybody's going to breathe it, they're going to be in the low rent district where we're not going to have most of our population. So breathe this stuff. So what happens is you burn coal. You make electricity through this process, generally generating steam, turning the turbine, running a generator, and you ship that electricity from far, where it's far from a population center, to somewhere in the vicinity of the population center over high voltage lines. And then you drop the voltage when you get in the vicinity of the place where the energy is going to be used, and then you distribute it. The electricity business has a funny way of accounting for this. They talk about transmission for the long distances and then distribution for the short distances, but you're moving electricity around anyway, so they're moving it around. So that's how that's done. Well, if the utilities are told that now they're gonna need to supply more energy because people are charging cars and stuff like that. Oh, and by the way, there's something else. Not just charging cars, but if anybody decides to invest in a solar panel to generate one's own electricity. What's your expectation when you invest in a solar panel? You invest in a solar panel, and you want the energy that you are generating to supply you. And if you happen to go on vacation, the sun doesn't stop shining. So you still get that energy. So what you would like is for that energy to be distributed to others, which means you want the meter to run backwards. So if you call Florida Power and Light and said, by the way, I have a solar panel and I want the meter to run back, they tend to stammer a lot and not respond to what you want. But that's not the way it's going to be. So I'll talk about what this new world is going to look like in a minute. But what's happened is you now have your electric car or plug-in hybrid that you're charging, and you have a solar panel, and now utilities are thinking, you know, it's possible that maybe I don't have to invest in a new coal plant. They certainly don't want a coal plant. By the way, most utilities don't invest in coal plant. When you want what is called peak power, you invest in these so-called peaking units that use natural gas. They use natural gas because it's a lot cleaner than coal. But they use natural gas, and natural gas does the same thing the coal does, except it's cleaner. And we have an interesting development in this country about natural gas, which makes it a lot more available than it used to be. But at any rate, utilities are saying, maybe we don't have to do any of that. What if all these people who have these solar panels helped in the process? What if we could convince people to use electricity in off-peak hours by having these meters? And what if we can convince those same people who not only have these meters, these same people who have solar panels, to actually, doesn't take much convincing to actually take advantage of the fact that their electricity, what they are generating, is now going to be distributed to others. And they'll run the meter backwards. Well, Microsoft, Cisco, Intel, GE, Apple, and Google project that by 2015, there'll be 28 million homes in this country that will use their meters, and that will, in fact, find a way to use their own generated electricity to supply others and maybe relieve some of these utilities in Arizona and Austin that are appealing to their customers to help, maybe use some of their own home generated electricity and distribute that instead. When you have a grid that is as inefficient as we have, you have other problems too. And unfortunately, when Microsoft, Google, and the rest of the actors get involved in something like the grid, they actually make observations, and sometimes they speak when they probably should be quiet. So the New York Times quoted Microsoft last year as saying, a traditional power grid is so dumb, in fact, that when a tree falls on a power line or a lightning hits a transformer, consumers are the first to report the outage. Only then will the power company dispatch a truck to locate and repair the problem. Microsoft was probably unwise in making that comment because the idea is to be friendly with the utility, not antagonistic. But at any rate, it is certainly true that we all have had experiences where we've actually called the utilities. Now, can you imagine in today's world that you have to call them to say there's an outage? I mean, that's just an insane thing to do. So here we are with at least the prospect for a major league change. Well, the prospect for a major league change can happen in any number of ways, but all the Microsoft and Googles and companies of the world are saying the way it's going to happen is we're actually going to have these power meters. People are going to do everything they want to do, and they'll be able to see on their computers or their TVs, they'll be able to see exactly what's going on. And, by the way, they're going to actually have a rather remarkable thing. If they buy these plug-in hybrids or electric cars, they're actually going to have a generator that they're driving around. So they might even use that generator to supply energy to someone else during peak times. Like, what if somebody drove to work, parked his car at work, and somebody at work said, you know what I'm going to do? If you don't mind, I'll use your generator to generate energy for work instead of getting it from the utility. So there are all kinds of entrepreneurial possibilities here for changing everything about the way electricity is being distributed. So the point of our system is that we have actually built a system. Unfortunately, we built a system that isn't a particularly smart one. We built it without storage. We built it with the assumption that we're going to always have to meet peak demands. And we built it with the assumption that change will be orderly. Well, none of those things happen. It's not going to be orderly. However, what it is going to be is a dramatic change for the way consumers feel, and, by the way, the way the electric car manufacturers feel. How many of us are actually comfortable driving a car that has a 35-mile range? We're not used to that. We don't like that idea. Now, all the people who got caught in snowstorms in the north, they're certainly not too thrilled with this, because if you're caught in a traffic jam and the battery degrades faster in cold weather, and all kinds of terrible things happen there, and they're certainly not going to be happy with this whole thing. So between the car manufacturer, electric car manufacturer, the plug-in hybrid guys, the consumers, and the utilities, which are forced to deal with the idea of either use what the consumers provide them, the distributor, the normal people they're supplying, allow them to run their meters backwards, or build new generating units. So that's the story of the electric grid. Now, notwithstanding the fact that much of the grid will be rebuilt and over time and all that kind of stuff, but from the consumer's perspective, the consumer is going to see something dramatic happen. All of a sudden, electricity is not going to be something that you purchase only, but also something that you can sell. Let me move to the... Well, first, any questions about any of this? Or that? Yes, please.
Electricity that's lost in the grid itself. The electricity drops off as it's being transmitted. So
certainly.
Tremendous waste.
Can't hear you.
There was an experiment done in which fluorescent bulbs were just put in the ground or near a grid. They weren't even connected to the grid, and those bulbs lit up. So they were absorbing all that wasted energy.
Good point. Good point. That's definitely true. Yes, please.
I love the
Wait a second. Why don't you get a mic first, because people won't be able to hear you.
I love the idea of your progressive ideas. I guess you would consider them progressive. And I lived off the grid. I lived on a sailboat and generated all my own power, managed it exactly like you're saying. And, you know, I grew up reading Mother Earth News, and the same discussion was going on in the 70s, and we've made no progress. However, recently, if anybody lives in the city of Sarasota, you might have been aware that the city had the opportunity to renegotiate with FPL or get away from FPL. This was recently. And they chose to sign a 35-year agreement with FPL. So the things that you're talking about, the way I understand, if we live in Sarasota, we will not have the opportunity to participate in that kind of thing that you're talking about, reselling solar power or even co-oping with neighbors, as far as I understand, for 35 years, but I could be wrong. The way I understand
I actually don't know the answer to that, but my bet is that there'll be a renegotiation because the world around FPL is going to change, and my guess is FPL may
actually...
Or else
I'll have to move to California, I guess.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, what is the place of nuclear in the generation of power?
Nuclear energy is a fascinating field. It is plagued with the radioactive waste disposal issue that has plagued the industry since the industry was an industry. Since the 50s when I and many others decided that the glamour industry of the future was nuclear energy and that we would actually work on trying to solve this waste disposal problem. Waste disposal problem in the nuclear field sort of goes like this. There are many new reactor types, the best of which are not even being run now because nuclear is the industry has been plagued with many problems, including economic ones. But the issue of radioactive waste disposal, if you look at the waste of nuclear plant, the half-life of those wastes is about 500,000 years. 500,000 years, the half-life. 500,000 years. Now, if you reprocess the waste, which all European countries do and Japan does as well, the half-life is 500 years because you transmute, you change the elements by running it through a breeder-type cycle. We in this country have chosen not to use that method. Now, 500 years is not trivial, but compared to 500,000, it's a different number. What's happened in the nuclear field is in this country we've chosen not to change that, to transmute those elements from 500,000 years to 500 years because we breed plutonium when we do that. And plutonium is a fissile fuel. It can be used for a bomb. So the thought process of our political folks was that you don't want to breed a bomb, so we'll stay with the 500,000 years, and we'll put all the waste in Yucca Mountain, which, of course, is no longer a place for any radioactive waste because the Yucca Mountain folks have this little problem. They don't like that idea. Well, the fact of the matter is it is arrogant to assume that the world will not change in not 500,000 years, in 500 years. It is arrogant to think that if you place something in a container and put the container in another container and put the other container in another container, no matter what you make these containers out of, to think that the Earth will not change over hundreds of years and upset those containers is arrogant. So until the nuclear waste problem is dealt with in a different way, there are many proposals and some very interesting and innovative ones. My guess is, to get back to your question, my guess is that if there are alternatives to nuclear energy, which there are, nuclear energy will not, in this country at least, have the kind of future that it projects it should have. In France, oh, by the way, what do they do with radioactive waste in France and Japan and so on? Do they have a Yucca Mountain? No. They don't bury them at all. They hold them in holding tanks. At this point in this country, we have about 70,000 tons of radioactive waste in holding tanks above ground. Now they're pretty secure, but in this day and age where we have all kinds of terrorist threats and that sort of thing, nobody's comfortable with any of that. There's no place to bury it, there's no place to store it, but we're storing it anyway, and we're simply not using it. France does what France does, and Japan does what Japan does, but the fact is that if there are alternatives, and there are, the alternatives will probably allow people to not fuss with nuclear waste. Sorry for the long answer, but it's a complicated subject. And I like the idea of I like some of the later designs of nuclear reactors, which are far superior to what was when I entered the field. Sorry, yeah.
I would just like to talk for 2 seconds about the arrogance of the power, because to meet projected future peak power, FPNL, just a couple of years, the goal of building another coal power plant in the middle of Florida, it was vetoed by Charlie Crist. And it's only Crist vetoed and invented that plant from going through. Now you look, and FPNL has a lot of ads about all of their solar power, solar fields that they're putting in, but they were only caught kicking and screaming.
To be pulled into this good guy image, it is to FPNL's, as you said, they're interested in selling power,
yeah,
and now they're being prevented from building major new power plants, so they have to find a more logical way. FPNL still is not offering you, a consumer, the idea of differential night and day rates.
That was right. Quicker. Yes.
My turn? My background is I'm one of the early off-the-grid people. I've lived off-the-grid for 20 years, starting in 1980, and chose to not invert because the inverters were not that efficient at that time, left everything 12 volts. And therefore, I've really kind of been on top of some of these issues. And I do know the utilities are now required to make a certain percentage of produce a certain percentage of electricity from alternative energy. I know the state of North Carolina, they're required of the public utilities are required to produce 18% from alternative energy, and the co-ops, the privately ones, are 14%. And I do know the utilities are required to, if you produce your own electricity, they are required to buy it back from you. So there are solutions, and now that solar and wind are now the pricing has come down per kilowatt to really make it so much more logical.
Good. Thank you.
I heard that we have enough wind in this country to meet all of our electrical needs.
You mean outside of Washington?
Would you comment?
Yeah. Yes. The wind in this... by the way, just for advertising, and you guys can... if, for those who wish to, I'm starting sometime later on in February. I'm starting a 6-week course of Purian Spring in breaking news and energy. There's a lot of news, not the least of which involves the solar competition with China and the whole idea of the use of the fuel cell for automobiles, and anyway, enough advertising. So if anybody wants more information, there's an opportunity to get it. The wind in this country is centered in the middle of the country. The idea is there's a lot of stuff there, a lot of wind. It's a large middle of the country, and if you take the wind from Texas up north, you have lots of resource. The question is, how do you store it so that you can actually use it when you want it and ship it to other places when you're not using it? And we'll talk about some of that. I don't have time to go into that now, but there are opportunities for storing sunshine and wind which we're not using and should be. That's a very broad subject. Wind, because of the way our grid works, we don't store anything. You generate and distribute. Well, that's very tough for wind because you're doing it here and you want it here. You've got to somehow get it there. and you want to get it there whether the wind is blowing or not. So the issue of moving it requires that you actually do some thinking about how you store it so that you can use it at a later time, not only at a different place. And that has become a stumbling block, plus the fact, the standard political stumbling blocks of people saying, well, I don't want wind energy off the coast of Nantucket because I have a pretty house in Cape Cod Bay and things, you know, that kind of stuff. You got to deal with that. Now, people in Denmark actually think a lot of those wind farms are pretty, mostly because they have some architects designing them, and they don't look pretty nice to me, but depending upon your attitude towards it. So wind has constituencies, lots of folks arguing against it. We need to think about how we store that energy and then distribute it at a different time or a different place, and then we might be able to make use of a resource that there's plenty of off the coast, on either coast, but mostly plenty of right in the middle of the country all the time. So it's a good resource. If it's used properly in our grid system, we don't have a way of taking advantage of it properly. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Yeah, I want to ask you another question about the use of nuclear and generation of energy.
Yes.
I was reading a while ago that there was a number of companies that were planning some advanced planning by building additional nuclear generators, but they wanted government help with the financing. I think it was government loan guarantees or something like that. And if you're familiar with this, my question is, if nuclear is reasonable to use, why is it that, and is it only the question of storage of the used fuel, or why are the companies don't have enough confidence to want government loan guarantees?
Well, there are a lot of, first of all, people don't like the idea of handing nuclear industry any more money because they've been subsidized for quite some time. So the question is, why would we spend even more on an industry that is plagued by the same problem that's always been plagued by? Now, having said that, the reason that the nuclear industry continues to have a problem is because of the potential catastrophic consequences of an accident. So the current pressurized water reactors aren't the way to go. There are other ways that are the way to go that would actually not be as anywhere near as susceptible to accidents. Accidents in the nuclear industry are horrendous. I remember in 1987, the Russians, for the first time, sponsored an energy conference in Moscow and asked a lot of people who attended the conference, about Chernobyl that had happened the year before. Now, in Russia, that was a rare event to actually talk about Chernobyl. I mean, those days, they didn't talk about any catastrophe like that. But it was a true catastrophe. It was interesting, the conference was very somber, where those of us who were talking about Chernobyl were seated across the hall. They were celebrating Sputnik, and it was much more raucous. And they were having a much better time than we were. There's a problem. The nuclear field has a problem of the potential accident, catastrophe. Forget sabotage, just loss of coolant accidents are the standard thing that one analyzes. It's what I was analyzing 100 years ago. Yes?
Can you give examples of new technologies that are having a negative impact on the power grid? For example, how much power does Google use to run their search engines?
I don't know the answer to that. My guess is not a whole lot. I'd say that there are lots of things that are allowing us to use energy more intelligently and use a great deal less of it. Let me use that question as a bit of a shill for the next subject, because it's one that is relevant. Air conditioning. Willis Carrier invented air conditioning in 1903.
1903.
In doing so, he changed the world. Kind of messed up the sidewalk cafe business, but basically changed the world, allowed people to work in climates they never before were able to work. And that was a very, very big deal. And in doing so, he did something that was so good and so effective that, in fact, the world uses the same techniques as it had then in 1903 today, pretty much. Some variants, not a whole lot. The way an air conditioner runs, you all know some of this. The way an air conditioner runs to take water out of air, what does that mean? To take, most of us can deal with 80 degrees temperature, 80 degrees Fahrenheit, if it's cool, if it's not humid. But if it is humid, most of us have difficulty even 5 degrees cooler than that, because it is the humidity in the air that's the annoyance. The way an air conditioner takes humidity out of air, you know the way that happens. You cool the air down cold enough. It's like having ice cubes in or having a glass of ice water. The water vapor comes out of the air and covers the outside of the glass because the water vapor is condensing on the outside of the glass. Glass is cold. You cool the air down to the dew point, the point at which water vapor will come out of the air and condense. That's how an air conditioner works. You cool the air down to the dew point. The water vapor comes out of the air. When you do that, nobody actually wants to be that cold normally. You then heat the air back up. That's not terribly smart. You actually use about 30% of the energy of an air conditioner to take water out of air. If you could take water out of air a different way, without cooling, what would happen? First of all, the air conditioner would be 30% smaller, cheaper, smaller. More than that, many of us wouldn't bother turning the air conditioner on, because all we really want most of the time is to take the humidity out of the air. So what I'm going to tell you now is how to take humidity out of air without cooling the air. If we actually look at a glass of water, we know that the water in the glass kind of rides up the sides of the glass a little bit, right? That's the so-called meniscus. What happens is you have a surface tension that's drawing the water up the sides of the glass. You draw the water up the sides of the glass by surface tension, and then surface tension has water adhering to the sides of the glass, and the next layer of water adheres to the first layer of water because water actually likes to bead around itself. Anyway, surface tension draws the water up the sides of the glass. If the glass were a straw, the water would come out up a lot farther because there's a lot more surface in the straw. If the straw were 1/1000th of the diameter of a human hair, the water vapor would come right out of the air and condense in the straw. Because water is more stable in the liquid phase when there's a lot of surface energy around to hold it. So now we have a way of taking water out of the air and putting it in the straw. Now the question is, how do you get it out of the straw? If you take the straw and put one end of it into salt water, and if the salt can't get up the straw because the straw is too small, nanometer size, what happens? The water goes down into the salt. That's called osmosis. Oh, by the way, the first thing, water condensing in the straw, that's called capillary condensation, something that has been known for about 100 years. A fellow named Kelvin discovered it and talked about it. If the straw is the 1/1000th the size of human hair and is dipped in salt water, and salt molecules, it's not that salt ions, which when salt water, salt is in the form of ions, it's not those salt ions are so big, it's rather that they surround themselves with water, and that combination of salt and water is too big to fit into the straw. So because the salt can't come up into the straw, the water goes down into the salt. That's called osmosis. Osmosis has been known for about 250 years, maybe. So now we have a way of putting all the water in the air into straws and then getting the water, that water out of the straws into salt water. Well, the fact of the matter is you can then actually stick the salt water out in the sun, let the water evaporate off, or use a reject heat from an air conditioner and get rid of that, the water that's just come out of that air outside. But the point is that you now have a way that doesn't take any energy. So the question is, where do you get these 1/1000th of the size of a human hair straws? Well, the filters that we make for reverse osmosis, you know, reverse osmosis used for desalination of water in Tampa and stuff like that, they use filters with holes that are 1/1000th or less of the size of the diameter of human hair. So you can have paper that accomplishes this. You just take the paper, on one side you expose the human hair, on the other side, salt water. Water goes right through. The water from the air condenses in that paper and goes right through into salt water. Suddenly the air conditioning field looks like it might be changed, because now we can actually do independent humidity control. Humidity control independent of temperature control. Well, if you can actually control the humidity independently, and if that's what most of us care about, you now have a way to change the air conditioning field. So that's another field that's about to undergo radical change. It might be a little bit longer before that one happens, because patents have just issued and things like that. But at any rate, that's the other way to change the system without making a big fuss. It's just a question of using something. Oh, and that you can, this dehumidifier technique can be packaged with the air conditioner, which will then be used just for cooling. Now, I'm sure I haven't explained this properly to some of you, so any questions about this one? Yes, please.
How does that differ from the swamp? How would you differentiate that from the swamp boxes that are used, not using electricity, in low humidity, hot areas such as New Mexico and Arizona?
Any place where you have to use a dehumidifier that is basically actually used in basements all over the Northeast and things like that, that you actually are using as much energy for that as you use for an air conditioner. So that's not a particularly neat device. It works. It accumulates a lot of water. The water is then shipped out somewhere. But it uses a great deal of, it uses energy because it works the same way as an air conditioner works. So it's not really saving any. Yes, please. All right, let's get you a microphone.
Hello? Is this on? Oh, just one quick question. Why, but you don't have to heat the thing back up, right? With the air conditioner, you take out the moisture and then you have to reheat it back up to room temperature, but a dehumidifier doesn't do that, so it would save some energy, right?
Yeah. Oh, it saves a lot of energy because you now have done the humidity control without need for any energy, and most important, you can become comfortable. If you're comfortable enough just by making a less humid space, you don't need any air conditioning. So then you'd never turn the air conditioner on, which is... Yes, sorry.
About the water that's generated from the process that you were talking about there, is that water usable in some
fashion? Yes, I mean, you can use this as a way of generating potable water. There are other techniques that you might want to fuss with, which we're playing with at the moment. But the fact is, it is a way to generate potable water. So the idea was generated strictly for saving the energy used in dehumidification, but you do get water out of it, and the water comes from the air. So, yeah. Any other questions or comments? I've probably taken more than the time that you guys want me to take, but anyway, the idea that revolutions happen in a field when we're not looking is something that we're all familiar with, because the ATM came about, and now we all think that the ATM was the way everybody always got money, right? I mean, we just assume that things that are have always been. Well, the fact of the matter is there's a lot of stuff that kind of happens behind the scenes that can make that happen. What we have though is the potential for a revolution in a field where it is innovation and invention that actually is the driving force for making it happen. The marketplace will adjust eventually, but as many of you have pointed out, that is often a slow process, and that may be in some cases a political one as well, and I don't have any answers for that one. So, any other thoughts or questions or something like that? Yes. Purion Spring, thank you for the question. Purion Spring, I teach at Purion Spring Academy, which has probably the nearest campus to here is one of Argosy University, which is down the road, 17th and Honoree or something. And the class is going to be on starting in later, little couple of weeks, and it'll be breaking news and energy, and we'll talk about China and the competition in solar energy and fuel cells and stuff like that. Yes, please.
Topic of today's discussion was supposed to be disruptive green technologies.
Yeah.
Are you going to get to that?
You don't think either of these two examples is disruptive?
I didn't get that from the title of the presentation. I was expecting you to come out against green technologies, and I wasn't sure what your background was.
Well, that's the problem is in your mind, not in my thought.
Well, I'm not sure if I'm the only one who.
That's okay. I mean, I was the cause of the title. I invented the title because it appealed to my sense of whatever. It doesn't matter, but at any rate, it has nothing. It was never intended to be what you thought it was intended to be. The idea is that green technology. Usually, when people talk about, you guys are clearly big fans and have used green technology. The big thing here is that many people think that you have to do something radically different, sacrifice a lot to get to green energy, and the fact of the matter is, in some cases, it's all advantage. There's no disadvantage. So I've just given you two examples of where it's going to be all pluses and equally every bit as disruptive as any other green technologies, but not ones that are painful, except maybe to some of the utilities.
Oh, yes. You were talking about taking the humidity out of the air, and then at some point somebody might still want to get a little bit cooler, I guess. But there's a process that some people were talking to about 3 months ago, and it's an old air conditioning cycle, which I think it uses ammonium and some other chemicals. And there's a Chinese company that's selling these over here now commercially, And it uses solar energy, not to power anything electrically, but to actually have the solar energy part of the chemical process, the cycle, which produces the cooling. And I can't quite remember how it worked, but I was just wondering if that's something that was part of maybe in your area there.
Well, certainly in my area, but I'm not. No. But from what you said, I can't tell what it is exactly. If you have a reference, why don't you email me the reference and I'll let you know. Most of these things are. There is a lot going on in China in general in the energy area, and it is something that that I think most of us are trying to keep up with. And I'm not sure what you're referring to, but if you email me, I will.
We'll take more questions in a moment, but before more people leave, I wanted to announce that we will have a special mid-month session 2 weeks from today on February 18th at 10 a.m. We'll present Linda Gustitis, who will talk about the Religious International Movement to Eliminate Torture. She's president of the National Religious Campaign Against Torture. And for more information, she gave us her website, which is nrcat.org. Question?
Yes. It was just unclear to me when you were talking about the problem with storing energy, whether from wind or solar. Is the obstacle technical? Do we just not yet know how to do that storage, or is it that the powers that be don't really find it in their interest to do it?
The answer is probably yes, but there are some very neat ways of storing energy in all ways. Now, however, batteries were invented in the first one was invented in 1850, so they've been around for a year or two. Battery technology is not advanced anywhere near as rapidly as it should have. Most of us have complained about batteries for our cell phones, laptops, pretty much anything for a long time because they've not come along as well as they should have. However, having said that, new and very interesting battery technologies have come along to store wind and solar energy. We'll be talking about those in this course, but they involve, and in one case at least, a battery that was invented by a young lady who actually eventually sold it to the Chinese, had a company that she started in Canada called VRB. VRB, the V stands for vanadium and the B stands for battery, and I forgot what the R stands for, but VRB went bankrupt. And the reason is, most of us conceive of batteries as little guys. We all want batteries that don't take up a lot of room. Well, a VRB battery is big and clunky. But for storing wind in Iowa, who cares? So the fact that that company went bankrupt is not a consequence of bad technology. In fact, it's fine technology. And her ingenuity in developing this vanadium battery was remarkable and showed the advantage of persistence because she was at it for a long time. And anyway, but it went bankrupt, and you know, sometimes things don't work out in the right time. Eventually we'll get back. Hopefully it won't simply be a success just in China, where they seem to like the idea and don't have any problem with the room that it's going to take. But I have seen enough of Iowa to know that there's a little bit of room there. So I don't think that's a reason for discarding that idea. But, so yes, there are things around. Any other? Yes, please. Why don't you, arthur.keston@comcast.net. arthur.keston@comcast.net. Okay. Any other comments,
questions? Mr. Keston, thank you very much.